day, we all will say, wasa, wasa lele.
And welcome to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. We have a great show for you today. And today we're going to talk a little bit about climate change. I guess climate change is the theme for today. And I don't know if you've been hearing, but this past April for India and Pakistan, temperatures climbed above 110 degrees Fahrenheit. I'm not sure what that is in Celsius, but it's crazy hot. And it's really the hottest weather that they've ever recorded in that month for India and Pakistan. And this heat wave has caused power outages, school closures, crop damage, and health warnings. So we go to a story today from Democracy Now! And Amy Goodman is interviewing Shanti Singh, who is a senior researcher on climate change adaptation at the Indian Institute for Human Settlements. And she is the lead author of the Asia chapter of the latest report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And in the same episode of Democracy Now!, there is a report following that with Bruce Young, who is the chief zoologist and senior conservation scientist for the wildlife conservation group NatureServe. And that story is about reptiles and how reptiles are not faring well in terms of adapting to climate change, and that the world risks losing 1 in 5 reptile species as human activity destroys ecosystems. So here is that story now from Democracy Now!
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in India, where temperatures have soared to the highest level since recording began more than 120 years ago. Residents of India's capital, New Delhi, faced 100-degree temperatures in the capital, Delhi, Thursday and Friday.
The summer that arrived in May and June last year has arrived now in April, in the 1st of May. It is extremely hot.
The situation is very bad. It is extremely hot and power cuts are troubling us a lot. There is no electricity for the entire day. The power cuts are more so. To get relief from the heat, we have to come here.
Again, temperatures reached 110 degrees over and over again. This comes as Delhi reportedly saw its second hottest April in 72 years, with an average high temperature of 104 degrees Fahrenheit. Meanwhile, cities in neighboring Pakistan recorded scorching temperatures of over 116 degrees Fahrenheit Friday. The heat wave in the region has led to power cuts, triggered health warnings, prompted officials to close schools in at least 2 Indian states, and caused widespread crop damage, including in the Indian state of Punjab, known as the country's breadbasket. Scientists link the early onset of the region's intense summer to climate change and say more than 1 billion people may be impacted by more frequent and longer heat waves. For more, we go to Bangalore, India, where we're joined by Shanti Singh, senior researcher on climate change adaptation at the Indian Institute for Human Settlements. She's lead author at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. She was also a lead author on the Asia chapter in the most recent IPCC report and draft author on the report's summary for policymakers. In a Twitter thread about the heat wave, she noted, quote, "It is deep climate injustice that those who face the brunt of the current heat wave have contributed so little to the problem." Shanti Singh, welcome to Democracy Now! Thanks so much for joining us. Explain the extent of the crisis in India right now.
Thank you so much for having me. I think as you laid it out very clearly right now, there is a very severe heat wave going on, not only in India, but in Pakistan as well, hitting temperatures of anything from 110 to 116 degrees Fahrenheit, which is absolutely debilitating if you go out in the sun. What is most problematic is that while some people have the opportunity to stay indoors and cool their homes, there are lots of livelihoods that necessitate you to go outdoors. people working as construction laborers, as agricultural laborers or street vendors, for example, have to go out. And they are, of course, seeing the brunt of this heat wave.
Can you talk about its relationship with the climate catastrophe? Can you respond to people who just say, that's weather?
Yes. So there has been a lot of back and forth on this, that how, to what extent can we attribute these current heat waves to anthropogenic climate change? What we know clearly is from the climate science that we are expected to and already seeing longer and more intense heat waves that are more frequent across the Indian subcontinent because of anthropogenic climate change. So that is already very clear. However, specific events, it's more difficult to attribute them, and that's really, I think a lot of scientists are working on that currently to say whether this heat wave is attributable to climate change. I'd also like to add that the World Meteorological Organization, the WMO, put out a statement the other day that it's too early to attribute this particular set of heat waves to climate change, which was picked up by a lot of media outlets. But the second line in their statement really reads that, this particular heat wave is as expected because of anthropogenic climate change. So it is a trend that we're seeing. We don't know. We can't say with a lot of certainty on this particular event right now.
And can you talk about how the heat is threatening India's wheat harvest, which is devastating not only for people in India, but also potentially for other countries seeking alternatives, because Russia and Ukraine, which provides 30% of the world's wheat exports, because of the war, that's completely interrupted that.
Absolutely. So wheat in India, of course, is a winter crop. And because wheat requires cold temperatures, both for tillering, so for the wheat yield to be good and for the seed to form in a certain size of seed. Wheat is then harvested in March and April in India and across North India, which is, as you said, the breadbasket of the country. And what we've seen is that particularly wheat that was supposed to be harvested in April, which is the late wheat, has seen a reduction in yields. And this, of course, has direct implications on food security for farm households as well as farm incomes. And many of our farmers are, as it is, struggling with the range of issues like water scarcity and poor soil. And then on top of that, this heat wave really adds to that, risk. So we've been talking a lot about compounding risk in the IPCC, which is that you've got a heat wave, but surrounding it, you've got water scarcity and also the pandemic. Let's not forget that. So multiple things coming together to really exacerbate risk for certain people.
You talk about compounding risk and cascading risk. Explain.
Yes. So this idea of compounding risk is, as I said, multiple things happening simultaneously. Last year, we actually saw a cyclone on the east coast of India happening while we had the pandemic raging, the second wave of the pandemic. So you've got multiple things coming together, which can really test your health infrastructure, the kinds of, our government systems that are expected to deal with all kinds of disasters. So that's the idea of compounding risk. On the other side, you have this idea of cascading risk, which is that what happens in one sector won't stay in the same sector. A classical example of that is agriculture and food yields in rural areas then cascading out to cities. So you've got things that are moving from sector to sector, which, of course, can also have a lot of ripple effects throughout the country, but even beyond the country based on trade routes.
And then talk about this issue that you tweeted about and you speak so much about, which is the issue of climate injustice. You said in a Twitter thread, it's deep, hashtag climate injustice, that those who face the brunt of the current heat wave have contributed so little to the problem.
Yes. So this really came out of, I have grown up in Delhi, and I have throughout my life learned to live with heat. I think a lot of Indians will say that we have our own coping strategies to deal with extreme heat. This time, for a range of reasons, I was out at around 2 p.m. walking and trying to get a bus. And then when I came back home, that long bus ride was quite excruciating, but I knew that I was going back to a home where I had electricity, where I could cool my home. I had an air conditioner, lots of cool water that was also clean. And so there was that to look forward to and know that I can recuperate from this heat exposure. And then thinking about as I was going in the bus, there were many passengers with me, many of them who I knew would be getting off at these very low income settlements that people who don't have, first of all, the resources to buy air conditioners or coolers of any kind, and then also the money to pay electricity bills that are needed to run these things. And so there's this. That's what I call a deep injustice, which is that, first of all, there is differential capacity to manage heat. But the second deeper injustice is that a lot of these people, their carbon footprints are extremely low. And so if we think about the problem of climate change, it's really not driven by low-income settlements and poor people across the developing world, across the global south. And so this is something that in my own work on climate justice and vulnerability I've been talking about, which is that historical emitters of greenhouse gases have to step up, because we are in countries like India and Pakistan really hitting the limits of adapting to heat. There is a certain limit beyond which humans cannot survive this kind of heat. So it's a deep injustice in that sense.
You've also said that while India's elected leaders have a critical role to play, you can't adapt your way out of this heat. Framing it as India's imperative alone masks the role high emitters have played in bringing us here. We've got to mitigate, and India can't do it alone. At the same time, you have UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres criticizing how fossil fuel companies are responding to the war in Ukraine. He said also in a tweet, fossil fuel interests are now cynically using the war in Ukraine to try to lock in a high carbon future. A shift to renewables is crucial to mending our broken global energy mix and offering hope to millions suffering climate impacts today. Can you talk about how these two issues come together?
Absolutely. So one of the critical things that a lot of climate change researchers and also civil society organizations are thinking about now in the run-up to the COP27, which is the Conference of Parties going to happen in November this year in Egypt, where there'll be a lot of climate negotiations at an international level. There's a lot of concern that finances that would have moved towards climate adaptation and mitigation might end up going towards, first of all, COVID recovery, and then second of all, just managing and dealing with the outcomes of this terrible war. So there is a sense of worry around that. And we know from all the work that various climate researchers are doing across the world that there is a sense of urgency. We don't have the luxury really of doing things incrementally. So first dealing with a war, then perhaps a pandemic, and then climate action. So there's this concern around finances getting diluted and the urgency going away from climate mitigation in particular. So I think there's and that's what I say really about India's stance. I mean, many journalists go on asking me about what should Prime Minister Modi do. There is a lot India is already doing, I think, on mitigation and adaptation. Of course, there's a long way for all countries to go ahead. But really, it comes down to how much each country can do based on their where they are in their development trajectory and the number of poor people they have to pull out of poverty and vulnerability. So it's not India's responsibility alone, while India, of course, has a lot to do.
Chandni Singh, we want to thank you for being with us, senior researcher on climate change adaptation at the Indian Institute for Human Settlements, and one of the lead authors of the IPCC report on the Asia chapter. We thank you for joining us as we turn now to continue to look at climate change, but at how a devastating new report finds that one in five reptiles are threatened by extinction, with turtles and half of all crocodile species most at risk. That's the conclusion of the first comprehensive study of over 10,000 reptile species around the world that took nearly 1,000 scientists and 15 years to complete. The study was just published in the journal Nature, found multiple factors are threatening reptiles, including deforestation, urban encroachment, hunting, and the climate emergency. This is environmental biologist Leslie Risler with the National Science Foundation.
species are declining at a rapid rate. Some estimates 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times more than the background rate of extinction that normally happens on the planet. So we're at a really critical time in our, you know, in Earth's history.
For more, we're joined in San Jose, Costa Rica, by Bruce Young, co-leader of the new study assessing the global extinction risk of reptiles, chief zoologist and senior conservation scientist for NatureServe. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Dr. Young. If you can start off by talking about what surprised you most about the results of this study.
Well, thank you for having me. Yeah, so you've described the major results. It was a long time in coming, as you described. For me, I was expecting reptiles would be somehow different than many of the other groups that we'd already studied. I mean, the history here, or the context, is that we'd finished assessing the world's birds in the 1990s. I participated in completing the global amphibian assessment in 2003. The mammals were done by 2008, and we just took a long time getting the reptiles done for a variety of reasons. And the whole time, we were sort of nervous that with all this information on birds, mammals, and amphibians that was driving lots of priority setting in the conservation world, that reptiles were being left out, that we know that reptiles are unusually diverse in desert areas compared to other species. And we just worried that they were really falling through the conservation cracks. So what surprised me of our results is when we looked at the proportions of species that were subject to the different threats, they're actually the exact same threats almost as birds, mammals, and amphibians. And so there's nothing new about what we need to do to protect reptiles. The other surprising finding we found is around this term called surrogacy. It's something that conservation planners use because we don't have information on all species. There's millions of species out there. We use the species we do have information about to set our priorities for conservation. And we hope that the species that we're working on are good surrogates for these other species. And what we found was that birds, mammals, and amphibians actually serve as good conservation surrogates for threatened reptiles. So that means if you do your prioritization based on those three groups, which we've had information for more than a decade, you're actually going to take care of a lot of the diversity of threatened reptiles. So that's kind of good news in a sense that there isn't this whole new category of conservation that we need to address today.
So if nothing is done to conserve reptiles, can you talk about overall what's happening to global ecosystems? How much time do we have to try to mend the loss of over 20% of reptiles on Earth?
Yeah, like I said, the fate of reptiles is wrapped up with the fate of many other species. I mean, I can't give any numbers in terms of, you know, how many years we have. What we found is that reptiles are actually the most diverse numerically in tropical rainforests. Again, that should sound familiar. We know that birds, mammals, and amphibians are also very diverse in tropical rainforests. So when you hear about continued deforestation in the Amazon, for example, that means we're losing reptile species there, just like we're losing other species. And it's causing that problem with climate change due to the loss of all that stored carbon in the forest there.
You talk about multiple factors, deforestation, urban encroachment, hunting, the climate emergency. You're in Costa Rica, in Central America, which has historically been the site, the whole region, for extractive projects like mines and hydroelectric dams. How have these industries, largely funded by multinationals, affected or contributed to the crisis?
Well, here in Costa Rica, it's a bit different than elsewhere. We don't have many minerals here. And in fact, it goes back to the whole history of Costa Rica. There was never gold found here. So it was a very different kind of people that settled, Europeans that settled Costa Rica compared to the other countries. We do have a tremendous amount of hydropower. But from a climate perspective, that's a good thing. In Costa Rica, 99% of our electricity is generated from renewables, principally hydropower. These are financed through international financing mechanisms and carried out by the Costa Rican Electricity Corporation, which is a nationalized firm. These hydro projects do have a negative effect on the environment, no doubt about it. River systems are changed. Flows and all that kind of thing are heavily impacted. For reptiles, it's not a big thing because there are almost no reptiles that inhabit these rivers that come off of the mountains. There's crocodiles in that where these rivers come out to the ocean, but they're not affected by those dams. So in fact, reptiles are relatively unaffected compared to many invertebrates, otters, and things like that that live in the rivers themselves.
As we wrap up, Dr. Young, can you talk about the UN Convention on Biological Diversity? What makes it so important? The UN Biodiversity Conference is coming up in Kunming, China, in October.
Well, our study reminds us of what's riding on this convention. You know, we just described 1,800 species of reptiles that are threatened with extinction. That's a small part of the 40,000 species that the IUCN Red List lists as endangered with extinction across the globe. That's a tremendous part of our biodiversity, our natural heritage, is riding on the success of those negotiations. So this is a big moment. For the last 10 years, we were under the Aichi targets that were set in the year 2010 under the Convention on Biological Diversity. They expired in 2020. And since then, there's been the negotiation for what the so-called post-2020 framework. What we learned from the Aichi target experience is that even though governments set those targets, there wasn't much kind of implementation of conservation measures. And in fact, when we looked at it, almost none of those targets were reached. So this time for this post-2020 framework, we're hoping for real targets with real mechanisms that hold countries accountable for achieving those targets. So as I say, there's a lot riding on these discussions and negotiations that are due to come to a head at COP15 in Kunming.
Bruce Young, I want to thank you for being with us, co-leader of the new study assessing the global extinction risk of reptiles.
And that was a story from Democracy Now! About that the world risks losing 1 in 5 reptile species as human activity destroys ecosystems. And Amy Goodman was interviewing Bruce Young, the chief zoologist and senior conservation scientist for the wildlife conservation group NatureServe. You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm your host, Ryan Young. And for the rest of the show, we're going to be featuring a story from Radio EcoShock, which comes out of Co-op Radio in Vancouver, BC. Alex Smith runs Radio EcoShock. You can check them out at ecoshock.org. And recently, he interviewed Robert Nassy, who is a French-trained ecologist and now the Director General of the world's largest forest science organization, called C4. So in this interview, we find out what C4 is and the changing role of tropical forests. And C4 is an acronym, and it's spelled C-I-F-O-R. So here is Alex Smith interviewing Robert Nassy, a global forest expert.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Isn't it wonderful how nature evolved to support us? Except that isn't how it works at all. A lifetime leader in conservation warns planet Earth is not a delicately balanced, benign being. Robert Nasse should know. Dr. Nasse is a French-trained ecologist, now director general of the world's largest forest science organization, C4. We will find out what that is and the changing role of tropical forests, especially here on a climate-challenged planet. From Bogor, Indonesia, Robert Nasse, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Good morning, Alex. Thank you for having me.
You lead a global conservation group with a multi-million dollar budget. You are an acknowledged expert on tropical forest life. What stirred you to poke around at this image of well-meaning nature?
Let's talk about what we are having here is an international research organization that has a mandate to work on forest trees and agroforestry, mostly in the tropics. And we are looking at the contribution on forest trees and agroforestry to the sustainable development, livelihood of the people, preservation of the environment, and crises like the biodiversity loss or climate crisis or inequities. What we are facing, and I've been in this line of quote-unquote business for almost 40 years now, you sometimes wake up with the feeling that we didn't make much progress. And what you read is this sort of idea that human beings are particularly important in the grand scheme of things, and that if we don't do anything, the world will disappear, and that we need to rebalance our relationship with Mother Earth and something like that. And I think that's very much a hubris thing. I mean, we don't really count in the grand scheme of things. I mean, a sort of humans are a blip in the history of Earth, and whether we disappear or not because of our foolishness, Earth will continue, life will continue in a different way. And so that's why I wanted to write this piece. And I think that if we do something now, it's not for Mother Earth, it's for us, because Mother Earth doesn't really care about us. So, and I know that some people may disagree, but I don't think that nature is a benign being. I mean, the thought of if a species disappeared, and we have had five recorded mass extinction in the past, some of these have lost more than 95% of the existing life form at that time. And humans, we are starting the sixth mass extinction, and we may end up being part of the list of the one going extinct. That's why, I mean, you need to wake up the people and say, guys, we need to do something is for us, primarily if we want to continue having a civilization and enjoying the beauty on Earth.
I want to get to a key sentence that you wrote in your blog post at the C4 site. You said, tipping points are rapid, brutal changes in socio-ecological systems triggered by slow variables. Now, there's a whole lot in that sentence, and I think everybody needs to understand this key thought. How would you unpack that?
The easiest example is the classical one is what you call the eutrophication of lake. That means that you have a lake in a place, and this lake is full of fish, and the water of the lake are more or less neutral in terms of acidity, and there is light, and so there is an ecosystem functioning. And then you have this lake is surrounded by agricultural land, and these agricultural land are slowly seeping nitrogen for the fertilizer in the lake. And for a long time, you don't see anything. And then one morning you wake up, the lake is different. Suddenly, it's brown. Most of the fish are floating belly up because they are dead. And then you have passed the tipping point. So the slow variable was the sort of the slow building of the nitrogen in the water. And then when it reached a certain level, then the lake flipped into another state. The tipping points were local. So you had a lake that was trophic, or you had an ecosystem, a forest that moved into a savanna because of degradation. What is happening now is that we are seeing emergence of global tipping points, and that's a big problem. Like people forecast that the Amazon will become a savanna within the next 20 or 30 years, and that will be irreversible. And if we lose the Amazon forest, we lose a huge amount of carbon sequestration and all the water regime, the rainfall that is linked with that. So it will become overnight something that is a big issue. And other of these tipping points are the melting of the polar caps or the changing direction of the Gulf Stream or the oceanic current, or the thawing of the permafrost. That things that will suddenly shift in another state and at the global scale and create havoc. And the additional problem we have is that there's about 10, 12 of these global tipping points, and they are interrelated. That means that when you triggered one, you will end up having a cascade effect, and then other will be triggered. So that's a melting of the polar cap will change the direction of the Gulf Stream, that will change the temperature and the rainfall in the Amazon, that will convert the Amazon in a savanna. And that's what we have managed to do with our activity. We have totally...
You know, we hear a lot about the Amazon rainforest. Let's talk for a minute about Indonesia, where you are based. How would you compare the importance of the great forests of Indonesia and the Amazon?
They are as important. I mean, so I don't think that you can give a sort of value judgment. One is more important than the other. The fact is that as of today, we haven't seen a tipping point like that in the Indonesian forest, because they are spread on a very different gradient of ecological condition, highland, lowland, several islands. What we have noticed, nevertheless, is the fact that there has been a steady decrease in precipitation over Borneo, for example. And that may be something that is the first premise of a potential tipping point, right? Because when the precipitation will become too low, I mean, forest will not be able to exist and will move into a more open vegetation. So I don't think that one is more important than the other. I think both are important. The one that is, in a sense, in the news now, because there is empirical evidence that something is happening, is the Amazon.
You know, there was sort of a major climate event in late 1997-98, that strong El Nino year, and Indonesian peat bogs that had been drained for palm oil plantations caught fire, and that deep peat released so much carbon dioxide that Indonesia, which is a developing country, rose to be one of the three biggest greenhouse gas emitters on the planet that year, and there was a lot of unhealthy smoke. I worry that can happen again, and perhaps that is... We won't call it a tipping point, but it is a major climate event, I think.
Yeah, it is a major event. And then unfortunately, it happened more than 97. There was a big fire in 2015 or so, and then 2019, related to similar issue. The fact is that this peatland, they cover about 3% of the surface of the world, but they store as much carbon as all the other vegetation combined. And so when they are going in smoke, they release a lot of greenhouse gases. And that's why, I mean, the government of Indonesia, following the 2015 fire, realized that it was urgent to restore this peatland where they have been degraded. And they have created a specific agency to do that. And they are embarking in a program of restoration of peatland. Not an easy feat, but it's a positive movement. And then we see the same also in temperate or boreal peatland, where people realize, oh, we better not touch this ecosystem and try to restore the one that we have degraded, because they are potentially on an area basis the most dangerous emitters of greenhouse gases.
One last thing on Indonesia specifically. I know that the two biggest pulp and paper companies in the country, APP and April, they're both planning massive expansion of production. I think they're going to double it or something. And I worry this will lead to conversion of more of Indonesia's remaining intact forest, maybe in West Papua or Kalimantan. What would be your thoughts on that?
It's a bit difficult to have a sort of a definite, informed opinion on that. If you listen to the proponent, APP or RAPP, they will tell you that, in fact, they plan to feed their mill with their existing plantation. And that may be possible. So that means that there will not be more opening or more cutting of natural forest for plantation. And legislation in Indonesia these days has a permanent moratorium on cutting any primary forest or any new concession on peatland. So there is some sort of safeguard, but nothing is really said about secondary forests. So it's a matter of how this company will be conscious, control. There is something that can be played by government in terms of legislation, but also by consumers in terms of not buying paper for a company that is cutting primary forest to make pulp and paper. The jury is still out on this one.
In the 1980s and 90s, I recall, and this was before there was a climate movement, saving forests was a focus of environmental activism. We wanted to save this valley or that valley. Hundreds were arrested here in Canada. Do forest activists now have to introduce themselves as climate players just to be relevant?
No, but for a long time, I mean, it's probably starting with, let's say, Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring. There has been an environmental movement, and this environmental movement has generally been opposed to logging or to cutting forests or any human activity that degrade the environment. For a long time, I mean, these people have been considered as marginal, and the interest of industry and corporation were considered more important than we cut forests. And what is happening with the climate agenda is that suddenly forests got a much more prominent public profile because they were a large repository of sequestered carbon, and also they were offering some relatively cheap opportunity to store more carbon if you plant more trees. And so that's why suddenly forestry and sustainable forestry was surfing on the wave of climate change mitigation or adaptation. It's a positive point in a sense for the forest. Is not a good sign because we have not managed to solve it for the last 40 years.
Tracking the climate challenge, Radio EcoShock at ecoshock.org. We are tuned to Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Dr. Robert Nasse, Director General of the Center for International Forestry Research, CIFOR. We're talking about forests, climate change, and human change. Okay, Robert, you lead the CIFOR group, and that now includes another organization called World Agroforestry. I will bet most of my listeners do not know what these are, because really you're dealing with governments and large nonprofits and banks, but not so much with the public face, as I've noticed. What do you do as an organization, Robert?
CIFOR and ICRAP, the World Agroforestry Center, I mean, are international organizations that do research, capacity development, and communication outreach on the issue of forest, trees, and agroforestry. And so what do? We work with many partners. And just to give you an idea, I mean, CIFOR and ICRAF is about 700 people. Half of these people are scientists and do research, and we are operating in about 90 countries. And we have a permanent presence in 30 other countries. So it's not a big organization if you compare to other organizations like the UN or FAO. But I think we have a meaningful and significant influence on the agenda on forestry and agroforestry. And then we are working with partners because we are too small to do things by ourselves, and because if you want to achieve results, you need to have a partner in country and that are believing in the same thing as you, and they are willing to do the same thing. And we have five thematic areas. One is climate change. The other one is about value chain, finance, and investment. One on governance, gender equality. One in soil health, land health. One on genetic resources and biodiversity. And we have a team of scientists that are working on the ground with partners in terms of answering the question that are asked by policymakers or by communities for the sustainable management of forestry and agroforestry. Of course, like many science organizations, we are not necessarily very good at communicating to the large public. But that's something that we realized a few years ago, and now we have significant communication program, use of social media. And so it's getting better, but I guess that, yes, a lot of your audience doesn't know who we are. But if you go to our website, I mean, I think it's in open access, and you can learn very, very quickly.
And that's at c4.org. I am a bit nervous about defining forests as tools for human use. What does the term agroforestry really mean, and can it be truly green?
There is a definition on forest, I mean, generally speaking, by FAO or by the Convention on Climate Change. But since I've been working, forester, I've been always discussing about the definition of forest. I mean, my best definition on forest is that when you are inside the forest, you know that it is a forest. Then you don't necessarily need to know what the percentage of canopy cover. And agroforestry is something that it's a form of management, and it's where you introduce trees into agricultural land to create a more complex and more diverse and more resilient system. You can have a rice field totally devoid of tree, or you can have a rice field growing trees together with the rice field. These trees produce fodder for your livestock or fruits for the village or shade or whatever. So they produce additional service that comes on top of your agricultural production. And because of the way they have been installed, they do not have a negative impact on the main commodity that you want to produce, be it maize or rice or cocoa or coffee. So that's the idea of the agroforestry systems, I mean, sort of putting more trees in the agricultural land. And although the term was coined into the Western countries, farmers in Indonesia have been and in many other places have been using agroforestry system for millennia. The home garden. There is a very long history of man in terms of using agroforestry system, and probably longer than there is an history of doing monoculture. When you had the hedgerow in the field in Europe or in the developing country, that has an agroforestry system. I mean, unfortunately, because of the way our economic system is working, people have had a tendency to drop this agroforestry system and to move to more intensive monoculture with higher fertilizer input, and that produce more on an hectare basis, but on the longer term, create a lot of environmental problem. And that's why we have this problem now with agriculture and food system that are the main cause of deforestation, but also one of the main cause of unsustainable land use or loss of fertility and so on.
Here is something else we all need to learn about. What is the Global Landscapes Forum, and what is your role in that?
The Global Landscape Forum is a partnership platform with now I think about 30 or 35 members. And it is really a place to exchange and the place to bring together people that will not talk to each other normally. So it brings together not only the forest people, but also the agricultural people and the people interested in fresh water, the people interested in blue carbon in oceans. So it's And you create this platform where the vice president of the World Bank can discuss with a group of farmers in one place. And all this, it's very important because a lot of the reason why we are not managing particularly well landscape is the fact that there is not enough communication, not enough exchange between the different players. And so that was the idea of when we created the Global Landscape Forum. That was a sort of an offspring of some event that we were organizing with Forest Day and Agricultural Day, putting together. And now it becomes one of the largest platform, and we have reached more than 250 million people through social media. When we organize events, we have more than 140, 150 countries, nationality participating to the events. For something like the Global Landscape Forum, the COVID-19 has been somewhat of a blessing in disguise, because as it was not possible to travel, we move into a more digital sort of event, and then suddenly you can have people that will not have the money to travel to attend your big conference, but now could participate through online platform, and we could reach more people. So that's the whole idea, in a sort of create a movement around the sustainable management of landscape. And by landscape, we mean large territories where there are several conflicting use, like agriculture, forestry, urbanization, industry.
You talk about the need to move from fossil power to a bio-based economy. How do you envision an economy based on biology rather than oil, coal, and gas? And can we do it without killing off more natural systems?
If we want to have a chance to stay under the 2-degree limit in terms of climate change, we need to reduce considerably or even stop our fossil fuel consumption by 2050. Because I don't think that people will want to go back to walking, using horses, or we will need to find a substitute. And this substitute could be renewable energy using wind, using hydropower, using solar. But some of the biggest greenhouse gas emissions are in terms of making concrete, making cement, steel. And so we could also use wood material, wood-derived material, to replace concrete and steel. But that means that we need to still have a significant amount of forest or a significant amount of plantation that produce this wood material. And that's a real challenge, because if we want to move into a bio-based economy, we need more forest, we need more plantation. And we need to have that at the same time without jeopardizing the need to feed the people and to have land for agriculture. So that's a big challenge, but it's a challenge that I think we can face. But we need to start now, because it takes time for trees to grow. And you see more and more, in fact, appearing. Some people are building a skyscraper with cross-laminated timber. And there is also the same with using biomass to produce energy, which may be topical, but in some condition may be something quite logical and something that will avoid using fossil fuel. So that's the whole idea. I mean, so if we want to continue having a decent standard of living and reduce our fossil fuel consumption, we need to find alternative. And we do have some alternatives in terms of energy, but in terms of building material, in terms of clothes, and we need to find other alternative. And the best alternative we have are derived from wood.
Is there an overarching plan to use world forests to help stabilize the climate, or at least slow down our damage?
We cannot stabilize the climate only using forest and trees. That's not going to work. The only way we can stabilize the climate is to stop emitting greenhouse gases and to start capturing some of the CO2 that is already emitted. Forests can certainly play a role in that, forests and trees. But if you consider that about 30% of the emission of green gases come from the forest and land use sector, that means that 70% comes from somewhere else. So that's, unless we fix the somewhere else, and this is the whole issue of using use of fossil fuel or a very green carbon intensive industry like steel making or cement making, we are not going to solve our problem. So forest, definitely part of a solution, but not the solution. We need a combination of less dependency to fossil fuel, more renewable energy, more use of biomaterial, and more forest. The advantage that we have in terms of forest is that when you have completely decarbonized the sector, there is a residual amount of fossil fuel that you will still need to use. And then you can think of that for airline travel or for shipping. I mean, it will be very difficult to decarbonize completely this sector. Then you can use additional forest or additional tree planting to offset these remaining greenhouse gases that you cannot remove from your industrial sector. So forest and trees and agroforestry system and for the matter ocean and seagrass have a role to play in terms of combating climate crisis, but they cannot be the only solution.
Is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
I think that in spite of all the gloom and doom, we should remain optimistic. I mean, and then we should try to solve our problem and certainly not running into the street with the cover in ashes and setting the doom day. And I think we can do it, but that requires that everybody act and not simply look at what the other is doing. And it's a matter of government. It's a matter of individual choices. But it's also very much a society matter. So I think we can do it if we want. We don't have a lot of time to do it, but it's now or never. And as I said at the beginning, I mean, a sort of whether we do it and we thrive as a new ecological civilization or we don't do it and we disappear, more or less, we don't care much.
From Bogor, Indonesia, we have been speaking with Dr. Robert Nasi, scientist and director general of the Center for International Forestry Research. Find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org, and you can go direct to www.c4.org.
And that was a story from Radio EcoShock from Co-op Radio in Vancouver, BC. That was Alex Smith interviewing Robert Nasi, or Dr. Nasi, who is a French-trained ecologist. Robert Nasi, who is the Director General of the Center for International Forestry Research, or CIFOR. You can check out their website by going to cifor.org. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. We're basically out of time here on the show, so we're going to let you know that you can email us at ecolibrium@ckut.ca. And you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/EcolibriumCKUT Montreal. And you can follow our website, which is equilibriumradio.weebly.com. And we have an affiliated podcast on Spotify, which is called the Ecolibrium Radio Podcast. So yeah, so thanks for listening to the show today. And we're going to leave you with some music. The artist Natalie Merchant has a song called Motherland. The album was co-produced by T-Bone Burnett and came out in 2001. So, here is the song Motherland by Natalie Merchant. Have a great rest of your day.
Where in hell can you go? Far from the things that you know, far from the sprawl of concrete that keeps crawling its way, about 1,000 miles a day. Take one last look behind, commit this to memory and mind. Don't miss this wasteland, this terrible place when you leave. Keep your heart off your sleeve. Motherland, cradle me. Close my eyes, lullaby me to sleep. Keep me safe, lie with me. Stay beside me, don't go. Don't you go. Oh, my five and dime queen, tell me what have you seen? Lost and the avarice, the bottomless, the cavernous greed. Is that what you see? Oh, motherland, cradle me. Close my eyes, lullaby me to sleep. Keep me safe, lie with me. Stay beside me, don't go. It's your happiness. Most of all, and for that I'd do anything at all. Oh, mercy.
or the most of all. If there's anything I can do at all, come on, shotgun bright. What makes me envy your life? Faceless, nameless, innocent, blameless, and free. What's that like to be? Oh, motherland.
Black Rose Books invites you to our book launch event,
Confronting Canada's Past and Europe's Forgotten Revolutions,
happening on Sunday, May 22nd, featuring the authors and editors of
Stand on Guard for Whom,
The Fire That Time,
Insatiable Hunger,
The Forgotten Revolution,
and Black Ukraine Yesterday and Today.
Join us on live stream or in person at 2 p.m.
at the Cité des Hospitalières, 251 Pine West Corner Park.
Free tickets are available at blackroselaunch.eventbrite.ca or visit blackrosebooks.com for more information.
This event is co-presented with the Cité des Hospitaliers en Transition and CKUT-FM.
The 7th annual Old School Bluegrass Camp is happening this July in the beautiful Lanark Highlands of Ontario. Old School Bluegrass Camp is a summer camp for grown-ups. At camp, you'll enjoy band labs, bonfire jams, exclusive evening concerts, fresh farm-to-table meals, and world-class instruction from some of bluegrass and old time's brightest stars. So come to camp and connect with your community, find your people, and meet your new best friends. Details at oldschoolbluegrasscamp.wordpress.com.
Through Tree Canada's National Greening Program, native tree seedlings are planted across Canada, creating a widespread impact. Planted trees provide habitat, prevent soil erosion, and reforest areas that have suffered tree loss due to pests and weather. Tree Canada performs 1, 2, and 5-year assessments to monitor tree survival and ensure the trees planted are on track to meet the forest cover goals of the site. To learn more or to get involved, go to treecanada.ca.
Whose data? Our data. When you're not paying for a product, you are the product. Especially in web and email services, where multinationals compete to manage your communication so they can make a profit off of the private communication you are producing. Coombit is a worker cooperative trying to help small organizations or individuals get their email, website creation, and website hosting services off corporate services such as Google. For more information, contact us at coombit.org or email at info@coombit.org. That's K-O-U-M-B-I-T. We are not on Facebook.
Fabi presents a Victoria Weekend Barbecue. Saturday, May 21st, noon till 8 p.m. at Mackenzie King Park, corner of Côte St. Catherine and Westbury. On the menu, pork and chicken, barbecue, jerk, and roti. Curry goat, saltfish, breadfruit and saltfish, also sides, homemade juices, and sweet treats. All plates $15 or less. So come on out and enjoy the outside with Fabian the crew. Music by DJ Jason. Saturday, May 21st at Mackenzie King Park.
Êtes-vous locataire à Montréal? Avez-vous des questions sur vos droits? Votre comité logement peut vous aider. Pour trouver le comité logement pour votre quartier ou pour plus de raisons.
To prevent the spread of the virus, wear a mask in public places, such as on public transit and in grocery stores and businesses. The best way to protect your health and the health of those around you is still to follow recognized hygiene measures. For example, washing your hands regularly and keeping your distance. Let's continue to protect ourselves. Find out more at quebec.ca/mask. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
I'm Noam Chomsky, speaking from MIT. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
Yo, do it for the hood, yo. Southside with an L because I'm fresh. Do it for the hood, rep. Southside with an L because I'm fresh. I'm trying to make my mama proud. I ain't trying to let my mama down. I'm just trying to make my mama proud. I ain't fooling around with
to university, I pulled up in Mercury. Mama, how we filled up with bags of Hercules. Soon as I finished pissing, I put the seat down. All my mama beat on, come on, damn, I'm retired. Only child, no siblings, no besties. I couldn't do nothing right like a lefty. Bought my mama first house with the jewel, man. Bought my mama second house with the club, man. Me and mama used to chop out the same house. Used to eat and go to sleep on the same couch. Me and mama got busted at the same time. When the court and told you the damn same lies, I can tell mama proud of her only son. Two chains, I have always worn more than one. Yeah, I'm real, I'm ill, you know you gotta feel. You popping pill, I'm rarer than $2 bills.
Yeah, I'm just tryna make my mama proud. Yeah, I ain't tryna let my mama down. Yeah, I'm just tryna make my mama proud. Yeah, I ain't tryna let my mama down. Yeah, mama ain't raised.